Hello and welcome to Immigrantly. I am your host Sadia Khan. Before we begin today's episode, a quick reminder, we are on Twitter and Instagram. Our Twitter is at immigrantly_pod and our Instagram is at immigrantlypod. Be sure to follow us. And also, you can support us through Patreon, GoFundMe, or by buying our beautiful tote bag. You can visit our website, immigrantlypod.com, for all the information. Your support literally helps us sustain the podcast. So if you want more interesting, introspective, informative stories, please be sure to support us. So now to our today's guest, Hari Kunzru. He is a British Indian novelist and journalist. He's the author of the novels The Impressionist, Transmission, My Revolutions, Gods Without Men, and White Tears. And his most recent work is Red Pill, a novel that explores the idea of searching for order in a world that frames madness as truth. And in a time where the current events in America feel like they are moving us closer to a dystopian reality, and it's hard not to feel frazzled by it all, because I am feeling extremely anxious, I thought it's a good time to sit down with somebody like Hari, who can give us insights into what he thinks is happening in America. So we talked about American politics, we talked about Hari's podcast, Into the Zone, his recent novel, Red Pill, and so much more. I'm sure you don't want to miss this. So let's dive in.
There is a great resentment in white America, despite the obvious material, social, and political advantages white America has. And I mean, the question for the rest of us becomes, you know, are those things that can be kind of rationally addressed through policy, or is it just I mean, frankly, I mean, I think a lot of it is just racism.
Hari, thank you so much for coming on Immigrantly and taking the time out to do this interview.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So we are going to talk about a lot of things. There is a lot to unpack. You have a new book, Red Pill. You launched your podcast, Into the Zone, which I have listened to. And then there is American politics, which right now is a shit show. But we'll start there. How are you feeling about the current state of the country?
I'm in a state of complete... I'm sort of beyond words, to be honest, right now. I mean, each time I think it can't get any more disorganized and absurd, it does, you know. And for Trump to release himself from hospital and then take his mask off and then announce that he's going to carry on as if he's not highly infectious is extraordinary to me. We're in a situation where the White House is the center of an ongoing COVID cluster, with new cases being reported every day. And yet they're determined not to act as if that's a real thing. It's like it's kind of totally got unmoored from any sense of reality at all.
Hari, but are you surprised? Because when American people elected Trump, they were electing a reality TV star. So his theatrics, standing on the White House balcony, waving to people, saluting, ripping off his mask and telling everyone that they should not be scared of COVID?
No, I think that's right. I mean, he is somebody who mediates everything. I mean, he roots all his relationships with the world through the media. And I don't think he has a real sense of his job as being kind of policy based. And I don't think he has a sense of his job as governing. He has a sense of himself as somebody who is presenting at all times. I mean, the videos that he released yesterday, as you say, with himself on the balcony looking like, you know, Mussolini, and the helicopter landing to the sound of martial music. I mean, that's like a kind of weird mashup between something from the 1930s and The Bachelor. I mean, it's a kind of it's all image and no policy. He has, as I say, no real intuitive feeling that the things that he does affect the lives of millions of people.
Are we en route to a full-on autocracy?
I think there's a chance of that. Yes, I think if he wins this election, I am not convinced that American institutions will survive. I mean, the discovery of the last 4 years has been that a lot of checks and balances don't function because they were dependent not on enforceable rules or laws, but just on norms of behavior, and the administration's decision to ignore those norms. You know, I think once impeachment had happened and the Republican Party decided not to impeach despite clear breaches of his duty, then there was no further sanction, and he's been acting in a way that's kind of unchecked.
Do you think he's aiming for limitless presidency? Because he has alluded to that in the past. Do you think that's something that American public should be scared of?
I don't think he has a particular strategic vision, but absolutely I think he would love to be the first president to go on beyond 8 years. It would feed his ego. I'm more worried about the structures that have sort of assembled themselves around him. There are smart people with, to my mind, very sinister agendas who have latched on to the kind of Trump's ability to create chaos and break things in order to reshape American politics. I mean, there are people who see this, obviously, with the Supreme Court as the main weapon. They see this as the way to reshape American politics around an evangelical religious agenda. There's the sort of Miller faction within the White House who want to return America to a sort of whites first agenda. I mean, they are sort of nostalgic for the days when it was sort of acknowledged that America was a white country and the rest of us were here under sufferance. And then, there's the kind of the old favorite of the Republican Party, which is the sort of deregulation, upward transfer of wealth faction. I don't think there is a real commitment to democratic politics that I can see in anybody who's around the White House right now. I don't think they have a sense that of the people as anything other than an inconvenience. And if they could kind of root round the need to persuade the population, I think they would do that.
Having grown up in Pakistan, I've always had this healthy skepticism of structures and systems and the government. And granted that Pakistan has weak systems, so that could be one of the reasons. But what really surprises me, A, is American population's naivety at what's been fed to them, and B, how America has always been dismissive of other countries for not upholding the same democratic institutions that we do, right? But what we've learned so far is that these institutions are vulnerable, as you pointed out, and if or when there is a democratic demise, are American people equipped to deal with that?
Yes, I mean, I think these are very good questions. I mean, firstly, you know, we're in a moment where a lot of people around the world are very familiar with what happens when the, let's say, the nominal rules diverge from the actual operation of power. And Pakistan is a place where people are familiar with the difference between what's supposed to happen according to the constitution and what actually happens, as are many other countries. It's notable to me that a lot of journalists are still reaching for foreign comparisons. They say, oh, this feels a bit North Korean, or this is like Castro in Cuba. And they can't even now bring themselves to see that this rot comes from within the American system. This is absolutely an expression of the anti-democratic tendencies from within America. It's not some foreign import or an alien thing. This is to do with the erosion of democratic governance here in the US, and it's an expression of a tendency that's been at work not just in the Trump administration but for much longer. As to whether the American people are capable of withstanding a full-scale autocratic attempt, should one be made after let's say, a Trump win or a refusal to concede in the election.
Exactly.
I'm very skeptical. I'm worried about that. There's an increasing feeling that this is actually happening to us here right now. But there's a kind of, I don't know whether this is something that's unique to Americans. I don't think Americans are maybe more complacent than any other population, but you know, imagine what it might have felt like if you were a sort of settled member of the bourgeoisie in 1920s Germany. The idea that everything would be about to come crashing down would involve you in kind of dismantling your life and dismantling your whole worldview. So it's much, much easier to say that's overblown, that you're being hysterical when you're saying this is a possibility. And so people allowed it to creep up on them. And why so many people were still sitting in their well-appointed drawing rooms when the knock on the door came. It's hard for people to imagine the complete upending of everything they know and everything they've been taught. And I suppose there is a particular complacency that comes with America's position for the last century within the world. It's seen itself as the sort of beacon of democratic governance and has assumed that the weakness that other systems display just wasn't there. You know, there are plenty of Americans who are much more aware of how things actually function here. But I think in the population at large, there's been a sense that America was exceptional in that way.
But I think that's where the problem lies, because the narrative that's been fed is that America upholds democratic values across the world, and somehow this ignores or sidelines the aspect of America's imperialist aspirations. There's less focus on historical reckoning, whether it's indigenous communities, genocide, history of slavery, Chinese Exclusion Act, or family separation, which has happened in the past. I feel if we spoke about these things more, we would have a better understanding of our weaknesses and deal more effectively with our inadequacies and have a more healthy and nuanced political discourse and not consider every institution as sacrosanct. What do you think?
Well, I think that's a fair point. I do think things are shifting now and that there are a lot of people who are far more aware of America's real position as a historical actor within the world. You still have a very, very strong pushback, especially from Republican Party politicians and supporters, whenever you point these things out, because, you know, you have the narrative of American exceptionalism that is at base. It's a religious narrative. It's a Protestant religious narrative that suggests that America is the exceptional country because they're building the city of God here on earth. It has a special destiny. And if you criticize that, you are, in a sense, doing the devil's work. Whereas, you know, you're undermining the possibility of the shining city of God. And so they push back very, very hard. But for most people who don't subscribe to that quite extreme religious narrative, I think there's a sense that, as you say, the conversation here would be more healthy if people were able to acknowledge what has actually happened. I mean, I grew up in Britain, which obviously has its own history and its own blind spots. But coming to live in the US as I did 12 years ago, I thought I really understood America's relationship to history. But I didn't understand how deep the wish to suppress some of it went. I mean, if you think about the history of slavery and what happened afterwards, even now there's such a pushback when you try to get people to acknowledge just the basic facts, you know, what happened during Reconstruction, how sort of systematic campaigns of terror were put in place in order to disenfranchise and exclude black voters. I mean, the question of empire is very, very interesting because, of course, that was one of America's great ways of defining itself against Britain and the other European powers. I mean, the narrative here is that they are bad because they were colonialists and America has never had such an ambition. Whereas, I mean, it takes 5 minutes on the internet to sort of scratch your head and say, well, you know, what did happen in the Philippines? What status does Puerto Rico have? You know, exactly. And there is, you know, there is an American history of imperialism and colonization, which gives the lie to that particular part of its sort of historical self-conception. I mean, the question is what we do with that. I mean, I think people on the right here always, you know, say, well, you know, you just want us to feel guilty. You just want us to weaken us through self-hatred. And I don't think that a kind of honest assessment is necessarily aimed at undermining national prosperity or whatever
it's
the accusation
not, yeah.
would be. I think it will, you know, it will allow people to make a political foundation that is more inclusive and that is stronger, that has greater buy-in. I mean, right now, America is a country which works very, very well for a small elite and increasingly has social relations that look like the social relations of the period before the First World War. The gap between rich and poor is as great as it's been in a century. And in order to hold together, especially at this time of extreme political polarization, somebody's going to have to find a way of getting everybody to buy in again. You know, everybody's going to have to actually give their assent to a political project in this country which will produce a good life and will produce a fair settlement for far more people than it does now. And I think, as you suggest, that a historical reckoning of some kind is part of that.
Exactly. And what scares me, Hari, about all that's happening, especially polarization, is that it may even deepen, because since Trump took office, the idea of boogeyman, which America has had fair share of boogeymen in the past, is changing. It's shifting, right? So before Trump's presidency, if you thought about boogeymen, you would think about Muslims or maybe Russians, China. But since his presidency, since he took office, it's becoming more and more of an insider. Now the antagonist is not a brown person as much as a liberal Democrat, right? The whole idea of antagonist is also evolving, and it's beginning to include somebody who you cannot distinguish on the basis of physical attributes or accent or ethnicity. And that could cause a lot of instability within American society.
Yeah, I think one of the truths about the Trump movement is that it is profoundly disintegrative. I mean, it demands the constant generation of enemies, and it demands, in order to function, a kind of atmosphere of turbulence and a permanent state of emergency. I mean, in some ways, this has been a long time coming. I mean, I think a lot of us would point to the reaction to the 9/11 events as being a moment when a lot of this was sown. I mean, with the kind of emergence of the security state after 9/11, a sort of permanent state of emergency was put in place then, and much of the legislation that rolled back people's protections against the state were, you know, are still in place. And we have to remember, of course, that the wars have never formally ended, that were started as a result of that. I mean, and with that, you know, as you say, the enemies have historically been much more easy to spot, and maybe we are in a position right now that is more reminiscent of the kind of Reds under the bed McCarthy era. You know, I'm very sort of struck by the sort of B movies of the 1950s, where, you know, you wouldn't know which of your neighbors is the alien. By looking at them, you can't tell who harbors this. You know, they were obvious metaphors for communism. I mean, there was a fear that the enemy was within the fifth column. And that's certainly a kind of apocalyptic mindset that's being promoted by the current administration, because it works to its advantage. And that is obviously playing with fire. I have no sort of sense, you know, if we were to sort of you know, play the thought experiment of you know, what would further disintegration look like, and what would the actual sort of geographical divisions be? I mean, that's a very interesting question. I can't. I mean, I think there's such a sort of patchwork of liberals and conservatives in all, you know, parts of the US. I mean, it would be very difficult for say a kind of MAGA state to be carved out of, I don't know, where, like Idaho or somewhere like that, that would be kind of meaningful and viable. But you know, if we sort of say that we are a long way from something that would look like the Southern states seceding in the 18, in the Civil War, we're still in a situation where I think the displays of force on the street, the militia movement, the Boogaloo movement, the kind of willingness to engage in sort of civil war type rhetoric could lead to, I mean, greater loss of life and much more violence. I mean, where I am in New York, one of our issues is the politics of the police. The police union has recently endorsed Trump, and if you look at the makeup of the NYPD, a great amount of the sort of senior leadership and the union leadership, they don't live in the city. They live out in Long Island. They live in the suburbs, and they don't like the city. They don't like the liberal values of the city. They don't like the people who they are policing. I mean, you know, the rank and file NYPD are very often people of color, and they're much more likely to live here. But certainly the NYPD as a political force is becoming more and more clear in that it has allegiances and it polices. And, you know, I mean, obviously there's the movement against police violence is very explicitly orientated towards defunding them and weakening their power. I mean, we have a very strange situation to me in the way that the mayor seems to be unable to control the police department, and the police department can do things like just decide not to work or slow down. I mean, there was a point in the summer where they seemed to be maybe trying to kind of generate a crime wave in order to force the mayor's hand. I mean, this kind of thing, these are our police, these are our law enforcement. And if they take a kind of political side, then things could get very, very sinister if they decide to function in the way that, let's say, ICE is functioning increasingly as a sort of internal police force. You know, I feel like that it's Trump's ambition to use ICE and the CBP as a sort of federal political police.
You know, it's so interesting you bring this up, because I think that's where, again, narrative matters, and America's idea of safety has to be reconceptualized. Americans feel safe around police, around law enforcement. And I've had these conversations with my Pakistani friends, and they feel the same way. I live in the suburbs of New York. I live in Westchester County. And I think, like, at least my town, I believe, is predominantly Republican. I see hatred towards, or not hatred, but resentment towards the other, or however you define the other. And we have to go back to how we redefine those narratives. And unfortunately, what I don't see happening with Biden and Kamala Harris's ticket is that they are not making a conscious effort to redefine those narratives, which may be because they don't want to jeopardize elections right now. But that, to me, sometimes is frustrating.
Yeah, I think, I mean, in terms of election strategy, I feel everybody feels the sort of the die is cast. This, you know, it's not when nobody's in the business of attempting to kind of persuade the base on the other side of anything. I mean, it's all about low motivation voters and I mean, the few strange souls who maybe after 4 years are still undecided about what they think. But I mean, I think it's what I'm saying is about a new settlement is that there is a great resentment in white America, despite the obvious material, social, and political advantages white America has. And I mean, the question for the rest of us becomes, you know, are those things that can be kind of rationally addressed through policy, or is it just, I mean, frankly, I mean, I think a lot of it is just racism. I mean, it's very, very deeply ingrained in some people that this is a white man's country and that white men should be able to define the terms. I mean, and there's no arguing with that. If that's, you know, if that's somebody's sort of deep conviction that, you know, something has gone wrong at the point when, you know, there could be a black president and that people of color could be in other positions of power. You know, I, as far as I can tell from sort of observing the scene in the last 4 years, I feel, yeah, there's probably about a 30% plus of white America who are, whether they would define themselves as racist or not, they are kind of deeply invested in white supremacy.
That's true. Hey, I want to pivot a little. I want to talk about your podcast and your book, and we'll start with your podcast. So I was listening to your podcast episode, That Ain't Country, in which you talk about boundaries in American popular music. And you talked about the term authenticity, how you're on alert when you hear it. You've even called it a racially loaded term because you think it can be used by various groups to exclude others as a gatekeeping mechanism. And you give example of your mom, who is English, and your dad, who is Indian, and both communities never fully accepted you as authentic, which, by the way, makes total sense. And I'm sure it's terrible for a person to be excluded. But when I think about authenticity and its application, I think the impact the word has is pretty much a function of who is using it for gatekeeping purposes. For instance, if it's a dominant population using the term to exclude marginalized communities, then the act itself manifests in dehumanizing the other or stripping them of rights and privileges. So for instance, and this is how I would structure it, if white people are calling someone less American, they are in essence establishing hierarchy of dominance, right?
The phrase real American, you know, is and the real America is thrown around in politics here, and I think it has exactly that function.
Right. However, in case of marginalized communities, the term, in my opinion, is an attempt to preserve part of their identity, which is sometimes already threatened by the dominant population, right? What I'm trying to say is if they were to allow people who are not quintessentially representative of that group, they are risking diluting their oppression. Do you think it matters who is exercising the right to authenticate?
Oh, well, I think you've hit on the huge paradox about any politics that sort of orientates itself around that, because what you say is absolutely true. I mean, if it's being, you know, if it's being used in the way that it's very frequently used to demarcate groups of people who are full citizens or full people from some other group who are kind of the waste, then it has the sort of the consequences that we've been talking about. But absolutely, there are plenty of marginalized groups of people who are attempting to take control of their cultural narratatives and you know, and their resources and by using narratives of authenticity. I mean, the indigenous people, for example, I mean, there's some very interesting work in kind of Canadian law around how one would think about cultural authenticity as a sort of cultural possession of Indigenous people. I mean, I think that gets into deep trouble very quickly, but as a sort of general, sort of broad brush principle, you know, it's intuitively understandable, isn't it? Is that you want to be able to say, this is the real us and this is not the real us. But then obviously you get to the question of adjudication. Who will judge who is authentic and who's not? I mean, I'm reminded of a situation that many years ago now in the UK, when there was a novelist called Monica Ali who wrote a novel called Brick Lane, very popular novel, and they decided to make a film, and the film was going to be, and Brick Lane, for people who don't know, is a neighborhood in East London where a lot of immigrants from Bangladesh, particularly Sylheti immigrants, came and made a community there in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and it's now the kind of symbolic heart of British Bangladeshi culture. And so, I mean, firstly, titling a novel that makes a particular claim, and there was some grumbling around her because her dad, I think, is from Dhaka, is not Sylheti, and she has, like me, I believe a white mother. So, you know, was she an authentic representative of the community? She also just happened to be a woman as well, which is a very interesting kind of inflection in this situation. But anyway, when the film was in production, somebody put it around that there was a scene in the film where somebody adulterates a pot of curry in a restaurant. And this is a neighborhood which survives on its restaurant trade. And the idea that in this movie they were going to kind of suggest that that people were poisoning food, this rumor got around, and a demonstration was held against the filming of the book, and it was very interesting to see it all kind of blowing up, and you know, it was a completely fake rumor. There was no such scene, and it seemed to be much more kind of motivated by the question of who should control representation of that community in the wider culture. And it also, in the way of all these things, had kind of local political currents, in that it turned out that certain people were running for council seats and certain people wanted to stand in front of the demonstration and be seen as community representatives. But the question is always, when you kind of offer a politics of authenticity to a minority, is who steps forward to claim the role of judge, and who are the community representatives? And very often it's cultural and religious conservatives. And in the UK, we've had, during the Blair years, when Tony Blair was trying to kind of regain support amongst British Muslims after having taken the UK into the Iraq War, he decided to offer some kind of legal protection against offence. I mean, you know, obviously there's the long history about religious offence in Islam, going as far back as the Rushdie affair and the various kind of post 9/11 provocations and so on. Blair said, "We're going to protect your religion from offence." And I mean, this worried a lot of people in the media, in the arts, and basically, I mean, I was very opposed to it because I saw that it was basically putting a weapon in the hands of anybody who wished to claim offence in order to shut down dissenting opinions. And the people who suffer in those situations are often minorities within the minority. So in a world where the old men get to decide who's an authentic representative and what offence consists of, it's the dissenter, it's the young woman, it's often those people who bear the brunt of that, rather than the people at the center who feel that they're offering fairness. So there are dangers with the politics of authenticity, even though, as I'm absolutely in agreement with you about the positive way that authenticity can be used to kind of define a community, to sort of often, you know, in a sort of post-colonial setting, or you know, for people to kind of regain their sense of autonomy and their sense of control over their own lives. It is a deeply complicated area.
That's such a good point. Hari, why did you start a podcast? Like, what's been that journey like so far?
Well, it's been great fun. I, like many of us, you know, I love the sort of narrative style of podcasts. I like the intimacy and the kind of informality of the sort of podcast narrative culture. And so when I was approached by Pushkin Industries, you know, they said, you know, we like what you do, we like the way your mind works, tell us some stories. And they were kind of amazing. They sort of said to me, you know, we'd like, you know, you to make a podcast about the things that interest you. So I put together a very loose kind of notion, and that it should be a podcast about opposites, about kind of the big cultural binaries that we use to organize our thinking, you know, life and death, public and private, these kind of, you know, very obvious things. But I'd use that to tell very particular stories, and often stories which trouble those oppositions or get into the gray area in between things. I mean, the question of life and death is fascinating in that regard, and that you'd think that would be the clearest boundary line that we could draw. But it turns out that there are, I went looking for the accepted scientific definition of life, and I found a paper which contained 123 rival definitions. and so even, you know, if you can't even say for sure what's alive and what's dead, and of course, you know, here we are, our entire the world is being dominated by a virus. You know, famously, viruses can't reproduce on their own, which is they need the reproductive system of other cells in order to make copies of themselves. So viruses are neither really fully alive or fully dead. They're these kind of strange, kind of borderline undead, you know, entities. And that's completely one of those is in charge at the moment. So, I mean, these kind of questions fascinate me. They're a way into kind of unpacking all sorts of areas of culture and politics, and mixing scientific stories in with historical stories, and, you know, doing what novelists do, which is sort of blending a lot of different things together. So it's been really fun to make.
And I've been listening to it. It is intellectually invigorating, I will say this. I've been enjoying almost all episodes. I listened to an episode where you describe your granddad's Haveli. It was such a visual depiction. It reminded me of my grandparents' house in the village where we used to go almost every winter. And so I highly, highly recommend it. And it's available on all platforms, right?
It is, yes, all the usual places that you can get podcasts. Into the Zone, it's called.
So let's talk about something else. You've said this before, that you've always felt intuitively that people are connected in ways we don't fully acknowledge, and especially we are in the midst of a pandemic right now, and I see that there is a shift in how American population is approaching the idea of collectivism and connecting with others. Can you elaborate on this? And are we like connected as souls, or are you talking about systems or society that really connects us?
Well, maybe it's something even more tangible than systems of society. I mean, right now, I mean, we have to wrestle with the idea that our health, you know, what more personal thing could there be than the kind of the health of your body? That we're actually interdependent in that way. I think in America, there's a huge resistance to any kind of level of explanation over and beyond the individual. In the US, the individual is a sovereign category. And obviously, the suspicion of collectivism has a history in the Cold War and the opposition to communism. And even before that, the kind of the battle between the unions and the bosses, which goes right back into the days of the robber barons. And I think a lot of it comes out of a sort of Protestant notion of personal responsibility. I mean, that's very much what you would still hear from a Republican politician here, is that you know, it's wrong to ascribe social causes to bad behavior, because ultimately, you know, you had the choice whether to steal the bottle of water from the store or not. And that has its limits. I mean, you know, I mean, even if you are, whether you're whatever kind of political liberal you are, and if you feel that the individual is a very sort of sacred and sovereign category, you still have to deal with collective life and collective action in some way. The pandemic has brought us up against the limits of that kind of thinking. I mean, the disastrous public health response here in the US, and the kind of absolute somehow sort of inability for people to imagine that they could work together in a sort of self-sacrificing way in order to minimize the impact of the pandemic. I mean, that's a huge, huge disaster for this country. It's been economically devastating, and it seems there's a sort of failure of imagination and a failure to really believe in the impact that you have on other lives. And other places which maybe have a greater sort of tradition of social democracy have done better, because the public conversation has sort of long accepted that there are certain sorts of things that we're all in it together for. You know, you would pay taxes because we all want roads and, you know, a fire service or whatever. I mean, and especially countries, for example, which have a sort of universal healthcare system. I mean, I think that's a profound difference. If you feel that when you fall ill, the state will catch you or the collective will catch you,
exactly,
that gives you a sort of investment in maintaining that and a kind of pride in that, I think, that is absent here, in that you know if you fall in the US, people will step over you on the street.
In America, the focus is also on individual because it's tied to strengthening state versus strengthening communities.
I suppose I put it slightly differently. You know, I think there's understandable historical reasons for why Americans are skeptical of the state. Very often local government has been rapacious and illegitimate and hasn't had the best interests of people at heart. And the kind of collective institutions that people have experienced positively are very often religious ones. I mean, the church groups here function, you know, to give social services and various other things, and they are much more trusted, for example, on the right than sort of the state would be. I mean, the narrative of big government, and you know, Reagan's famous but rather fatuous statement of, you know, the most scary words in the American language are I'm from the government, I'm here to help. You know, I think people need to kind of reconceptualize their relationship to collective action and to collective governance, just because, from the very practical reason, I mean, it's not working. What is happening here is a disaster unparalleled anywhere else in the world, and it's a disaster that has grown up partly because of this massive distrust of any kind of disbelief in the collective. It's more than mistrust. It's like a kind of deep-seated inability to imagine a collective life in which we might all have stakes together. I mean, this obviously has consequences for beyond the pandemic. And the environment is the obvious commons that we all have to try and maintain in some way. So there's going to have to be a new politics and a new political imaginary that doesn't reduce the dignity of the individual, and it doesn't reduce, I think, in most meaningful ways, the freedom of the individual. In fact, I mean, from my point of view, you're much freer if you're not terrified of falling ill all the time. You're not terrified of being bankrupted because you have an illness. I mean, that freedom to choose your doctor is a banal, silly little freedom compared to the freedom to go about your life without fear of sickness. So there are kind of, I mean, maybe what we need is a redefinition of freedom. I mean, for freedom is the American concept supreme, then we need to rethink what that actually means.
Yeah, because America is a country where nuclear weapons that are, by the way, funded by public are source of freedom, or at least symbolize freedom, while public funded healthcare is considered oppressive.
Exactly.
Isn't that ironic?
Well, the example that people often turn to here is the internet, which is a government funded sort of research tool initially. And, you know, instead of, I mean, Silicon Valley, which prides itself in being this kind of, you know, maverick libertarian bandits, I mean, that's actually an outgrowth of massive government subsidy from the Cold War. So there's a lot of bad faith here. You know, it's the same bad faith that red state senators have when they talk about the horrors of the federal government without kind of explaining to their constituents that actually they're subsidized in their small state by the tax base of large states like New York and California. So without federalism, Kansas wouldn't function. You know, North Dakota wouldn't be able to function. Alaska in particular would not be able to function. So there are unacknowledged kinds of collectivism in the US culture,
which nobody talks about.
Exactly. And I think, you know, there's something we could have an honest conversation about, the sort of the actual systems and networks of collective life here.
Ari, you're also a novelist. How much of yourself do you give to your characters, if at all?
Well, I mean, they're all me in one sense. Obviously, they all have some sliver or fragment of me in them. I'm not somebody who can write very straightforwardly autobiographically. I like to kind of refract my various feelings and opinions through characters. And I like the novel because it allows me to sort of stage things in a way. I can stage conflicts and debates and situations and kind of play them out. I mean, I was a teenage role player, and I think that's probably got some bearing on my love of fiction.
As a novelist, what kind of relationship do you have with your intuition, and how much does that go into your writing?
I kind of try and garden it, if that's a sort of meaningful thing. I think it's very important to have a non-rational part to your creative practice. You know, I mean, a lot of my life is to do with constructing arguments and debates and being coherent and conducting other kinds of conversation. But with the fiction, often a starting point for me is a kind of collection of images or feelings that I feel should go together. And the novel is a way of kind of exploring those and just working out why that sort of intuitive arrangement of things should make sense. You know, I mean, a novel can start from me, or, you know, has started from me from very abstract images. And I often kind of leave it as late as possible in the process to really nail down certain reasons why things are happening. I mean, I wrote a novel set out in the California desert. And I knew there needed to be a couple with a missing child, and I knew there needed to be something to do with UFOs. And for a long time, I had absolutely no understanding why those things should be together. But I held my nerve until a sort of connection started to arise.
That's so interesting. So your recent novel, Red Pill, it's a story about surveillance and privacy. It talks about paranoia. It talks about mental health. Donald Trump's election into the White House. How was it writing a novel explaining American dystopia and yet experiencing it in a way or living it at the same time?
Well, a novel is inevitably always a filter for the feelings and thoughts that you have while you're writing it. And I mean, in a way, it's been very good for me in the last few years to have to be able to sit down at my desk and scream silently. It sort of allowed me to function more or less normally in the rest of my life. But the real thing that I wanted to capture in Red Pill is a sense of anxiety that I think is almost universal at the moment, whether and it's not just Trump, it's a wider sense that the sort of culture is shifting and that the future is much more uncertain maybe than we gave it credit for. And I wanted to describe that because I think that's the feeling that's very much, it's a feeling with complex causes, and it's a sort of slightly ineffable feeling that I wanted to get down on paper now, because I think in 3 years' time we'll feel differently. And, you know, I mean, with any luck, we will feel better. But for now, that seemed to be a job that a novel could do very well, that a sort of essay or an argument about the news couldn't. It's to sort of try and reflect back to people the sort of profound unease that seems to underlie everything at the moment, the thing that makes us stay up late at night scrolling on our phones.
And it could be cathartic, work of imagination, writing a novel.
On a personal level, it always is. I mean, if you give form to something, you're able to name it. You're able to kind of, to look at it and say, yes, this is what I'm feeling, and this is maybe why I'm feeling it. So yes, it does me good, and I hope it does the reader good as well.
You have two kids, right?
I do.
If you had to pick one thing you wanted your children to learn from you, what would it be?
That's so hard to answer. I mean, compassion. I think that would be, there's an attitude towards the world that I would like them to have, you know, regardless of what they do. I would like them to have compassion for others and compassion for and to approach the world in that spirit.
And all the craziness and the chaos around us, how are you creating order in your life right now? Is there a routine? Are you doing something special? Is there a self-care routine that you follow?
There is a routine. I mean, I'm lucky in that I have the ability to work, and we do have some childcare, which makes all the difference. So, I mean, I'm trying to kind of forget there was once a world where I visited other places and went to restaurants and so on, and I'm so far you know, we're healthy, and my parents, who I haven't been able to see for almost a year now, are still healthy, although they're, you know, isolated in Britain and, you know, aren't able to move around very much. My work is providing a lot of that, just a very sort of simple routine of cooking and making sure the children feel safe and happy. And what I mean, actually right now watching very tense French spy drama on the streaming every evening. That's a routine. The end of the day is a little more doom scrolling on the phone, look at whatever chaos has happened, and watching spies who have much bigger troubles than mine.
You know, I started watching Schitt's Creek and I've been binge watching that series. Like, I'm almost done with the entire series. It has 6 seasons, and I was wow. You know, this is what I need right now. My husband, on the other hand, he likes to watch anime, which I never understood why, but that's his thing.
We watch some Miyazaki together as a family. I mean, we're Spirited Away and Ponyo and these just, I've never been a huge anime guy. I mean, Akira and one or two others were kind of big moments, but wow, I mean, you and your husband clearly have to have 2 different screens then.
You know, surprisingly, he also enjoys Schitt's Creek.
Oh, well, that's good. That's clearly why you're married. There is a common ground there.
Exactly. But I can't watch anime. So when he puts it on, when he switches it on, I just leave the room. I'll go to read something, do something else, browse on my phone, but I just can't watch anime. It's not my thing. I can't even sit through it. I don't know why. But yeah. Hari, in the end, if you were to describe America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
Messy. I mean, you know, I'm all in here. You know, I've become, you know, this is where my life is, and this is where, you know, my children were born here. I need this place to work, and so this is why I'm, you know, I'm as engaged as I am with the political conversation here. So I mean, I find it infuriating, messy, and not without hope.
That's a great way to put it. And as you said, we're all here because we want to be. Our children were born here, and we want this place to work, and that's why we criticize it. Because to me, criticism and dissent is patriotic. That's how you express yourself, and that's how you hope things will get better.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, the idea that criticism is unpatriotic, I think, is one of the great mistakes of the American conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Hari. This was so good. And by the way, where can people find your book and your podcast?
So the podcast is called Into the Zone and is available on, you know, Apple and Stitcher and all the other places where people get their podcasts. The book is called Red Pill, and you know, get it from the nearest independent bookstore to you, because they need your love right now.
Thank you so much, Hari. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Sadia.
Thank you, everyone, for spending some time with me. I hope you guys enjoyed my conversation with Hari, which was undoubtedly one of the most intellectually invigorating conversations I've had with a guest. Don't forget to check Hari's podcast, Into the Zone, which is available on every major platform, and so is Immigrantly. Write to us and tell us what you thought about this episode. Our email is info@immigrantlypod.com. Until next time, take care.